Hey guys, so my name is Attica, and today I am going to be going over the Verrine Orations by Cicero, who we all know is my personal favourite. Okay, so for some background, Marcus Tullius Cicero was born on the 3rd of January in 106 BC in a small town called Arpinum, which was just outside of Rome. He is known for his philosophy, for his oratory, and his letters to his best friend Atticus, which capture his flawed, passionate personality that makes him so intensely human and so relevant to every single person in the last two millennia who has picked up his work. Before I get to my dramatic reading of In Verum, or the Verrine Orations, I'm going to give you a little bit of context, okay? So, it's 70 BC, right in the middle of the scorching heat that was the late Roman Republic. Cicero is 36 years old, which is very important. In Rome, there was a kind of political career ladder called the Cursus Honorum. The order from the bottom up was tribune, quaestor, aedile, praetor, consul. And we're not going to get into dictators right now. At each stage, in accordance with the Republic, which in theory was all about fairness, principles, democracy through the voice of the Senate and the people of Rome, hashtag SPQR, you get the gist, guys. You had to be a particular age and probably have a particular volume of wealth. Again, we won't get into it. Now, I'm sure you'll be surprised to know there was a lot of bribery and corruption in Rome, especially in the Senate and the law courts. So a lot of men, because of course politics was only open to men, managed to jostle their way into positions when they were a lot younger than they legally should have been, probably thanks to, you know, a hint of bribery and a pinch of good old nepotism. But what is important, guys, like really important, is that Cicero did things by the book. You can say what you want about him, but he adored the good old Republic. And so it's very significant that in 70 BC, Cicero was 36 years old, the minimum age to be elected legally as an aedile. And he just so happened to be running for this position alongside the delivery of the Verrine Orations. It's almost as if he knew that these might boost his public political prestige. On a side note, by the way, it's even more amazing that Cicero managed to stick to the rules and climb the political ladder because he was a novice homo, or a new man in English. This was rare, by the way, let me tell you guys. Most men in Roman politics, and therefore in the Senate, were patrician, which meant they were kind of a whole other level of elite, and they had wealth and fame and prestige and glory and all those, you know, crazy things stretching back, in many cases, for hundreds of years. I mean, some of them claimed to be descended from the people who actually came up with the Republic. So whenever you think of Cicero, and you hear him going on a bit about how cool he was, or how he, you know, kind of saved the Republic, you know, twice, remember that he came from nothing in comparison. He literally started from the bottom and now he's here, okay? Cicero's family were not abundantly wealthy, nor all that prestigious. In fact, there's a story in Plutarch's Life of Cicero that the family name, or cognomen, which is like surname, so Cicero, actually derives from the Latin word for chickpea, because they all had this like little lump on the end of their noses with a little cleft in it, like a chickpea. So, you know, Cicero's out there trying to do his best, and it's not really the same heritage as if, you know, you're descended from all the Scipios, is it? You see what I mean? Poor guy had to put up with quite a lot. So Cicero worked damn hard to rise through the ranks in politics, and he did it through pure nerve and talent, surrounded by all those enormous egos, and, you know, he probably suffered a severe case of imposter syndrome as well. I reckon we can allow him to be a little bit boastful. Okay, so, 70 BC. Gaius Verres is governor for Sicily, Rome's oldest province. He's been extorting the hell out of the place for about 3 years, which basically means he's been taking as much money from it as physically possible and basically just being awful to all the people there. A lot of the Roman senators who govern provinces actually did this. At the time, looking after a province was literally seen as like a get-rich-quick scheme rather than a, you know, job with a sense of moral duty and care. Now, Gaius could also get away with this because he'd been fairly pally with Sulla, who'd basically been in charge of things in Rome until about 78 BC when he died. But Cicero had been a quaestor in Sicily about 5 years earlier, and he'd got to know the Sicilians quite well. And after his fame from his defence of Sextus Roscius, which was the pro-Roscio, and that's for Roscius, it's a few years ago, that kind of was the case that catapulted Cicero into the political limelight. The Sicilians actually came to him with complaints about the way they had been treated, which you can imagine he kind of liked. Cicero, by the way, did actually have a few reasons to take this case. Firstly, he genuinely hated dishonest government and administration. It literally goes against all his republican values. Secondly, there had been a lot of issues between two classes of Romans at the time. So you've got the senators, who were often patricians, like I've mentioned. You've got the plebeians, who... that's not a slur like it is nowadays. Those were just the normal, ordinary bodies of, like, Roman citizens. And kind of in the middle, but more like a sidestep across, you've got the equestrians, or the knights. Now, these guys were fairly wealthy, but more kind of a middling class, and they tended to look after the taxes and the finance side of things. They had once looked after the law courts, but Sulla gave all the law courts to the senators. And that meant that there was a lot of bribery and corruption going on because all the senators were best mates with one another and could basically just bail each other out when they wanted to. Now, at this point in the year, the Lex Aurelia was trying to be passed. Now, this was a law that was going to allow the senators and the equites to come back together to run the courts together. Roman laws, by the way, were kind of named after the person who proposed them. So Lex Aurelia, we can presume the bloke who proposed it was called Aurelius. Now, what is so important is this was being proposed in the year Verres was standing trial. And on top of that, Cicero was also an equestrian himself, right? So he's standing up there supporting the ideals that we could move the senators and equites back together again, because Cicero had this ideal in his head called the Concordia Ordinum, which didn't really work, but this concept was that the equites and senators would be friends and like would get on and be united for the republic. So Cicero is kind of standing up there saying, look how corrupt everything has become under just senators. The equites were really good at it. I'm an equite too. If we bring it all together, if you condemn Verres, then you are supporting this law to mix things together. But if you let Verres off, you're basically admitting that you are all corrupt. And this actually worked really well, and the Aurelian law was actually passed. Thirdly, as mentioned, this case would boost Cicero's political career and the chance to be in the running to win the aedileship. And finally, he was going to be going up against Hortensius, Verres' lawyer, who was, until Cicero rocked up, the most distinguished orator of the day. Emphasis on was. Now, something to bear in mind. Cicero was still a little bit of a fish out of water at this time. Hortensius and Verres were two very formidable opponents, and as well as their experience, their age, their wealth, their ancestry, you name it, they were also kind of assholes. They knew that the praetor in charge of the extortion courts at the time was a bloke called Glabrio, who was basically a decent human being. But in the new year, a new load of senators would be running the courts, all of the men who just so happened to be besties with Hortensius or Verres. At the point the case was being argued, the year was coming to a close and there were loads of all these festivals coming up. Now, the Romans didn't work on holidays. Hortensius and Verres planned to draw out the trial for as long as possible so it would run into the festivals and inevitably be picked up in the new year by the new presiding senators, who would ultimately let Verres off with a bit of a slap on the wrist. So the whole derailment of this case therefore hinged on Roman custom, and Cicero knew this. So he asked the court to allow him to alter the format of the trial. Instead of the prosecution and defence making a series of speeches in turn and calling witnesses, which would basically allow Hortensius to talk and talk and talk until forever, and I have no doubt he could have done it, Cicero asked to call the witnesses immediately to give evidence for the charges. Thus, we have the first Verrine oration. Now, before I begin, there's just a couple of points to note about the speeches themselves, like stylistic things. So he does three main stylistic techniques in the speeches. One is hyperbole, which is basically exaggeration. So like when he says, Verres' deeds have been contemned by the entire world. I mean, obviously, no, they haven't, but it sounds good, doesn't it? There's also tricolon, which kind of runs in concurrence often with hyperbole. So this is where Cicero kind of builds up to a point in like threes. So for example, the case depends on the witnesses, the facts, and the power of the judges. Yeah? And then finally, we have omission, which is my personal fave. Okay, so this is where Cicero omits certain information. So he doesn't tell you everything, but he basically does tell you at the same time. For example, I won't describe all his gross sexual deeds. I mean, okay, he doesn't, but damn, you are not going to look at Verres the same way across the forum, are you? Right. I think we've covered everything. Are you ready? Here we go. Judges, at this grave crisis in the history of our country, you have been offered a peculiarly desirable gift, a gift almost too opportune to be of human origin, to make your senatorial order less unpopular and to set right the damaged reputation of these courts. A belief has taken root which is having a fatal effect on our nation and to which us senators threatens grave peril. This belief is on everyone's tongue at Rome and even in the foreign countries. It is this, that in these courts, with their present membership, even the worst criminal will never be convicted, provided that he has money. That then is the dangerous crisis with which your order and your courts are faced. Speeches have been prepared, laws are drafted, such as the Lex Aurelia, with the purpose of inflaming still further this hatred that already rages against the Senate. And at this very juncture, Gaius Verres has been brought to trial. Here is a man whose life and actions the world has already condemned, and yet whose enormous fortune, according to his own loudly expressed hopes, has already bought him an acquittal. I, gentlemen, am his prosecutor, and the people of Rome are strongly and confidently on my side. To increase the unpopularity of your order is very far from my intention. On the contrary, I am eager to remove your bad reputation, which is much mine as yours. The defendant whom I am prosecuting, being the man he is, provides you with your opportunity to recover the lost prestige of these courts and regain the favour of the Romans and the outside world alike. Verres has sacked the treasury. He has devastated Asia. His praetorship was a record of robberies, and the province of Sicily found him an annihilating pestilence. Pronounce a just and scrupulous verdict against Verres, and you will keep the good name which ought always to have been yours. Let us imagine, on the other hand, that his great wealth succeeds in undermining the conscience and honesty of the judges. Well, even then I shall accomplish one thing. For the general conclusion will not be that the judges failed to find a guilty defendant, or that the defendant lacked a competent prosecutor. No, on the contrary, the deduction will be that there are no good judges in the land. I have a personal statement to make. Gaius Verres has set me many traps, all of which I have avoided. But I have never felt so conscious of danger, never so apprehensive as I do in this court today. But these plots against me are not what causes me the concern. No, what alarms me is the fresh series of criminal plots that Verres has laid. By their means, he proposes to ensnare at one and the same time myself, yourselves, the presiding praetor Glabrio, indeed the whole Roman people itself. Not to speak of the senatorial order and everything for which it stands. The people who have reason to fear prosecutions, Verres assures his friends, are those who have only stolen just enough for their own use, whereas what he, on the contrary, has stolen is enough to satisfy many people. Nothing, he declares, is too sacred to be corrupted by money, nothing too strong to resist its attack. If the secrecy with which his projects are put into effect were comparable to the criminality which inspires their design, he might, to some extent, have kept them from my notice. But, conveniently enough, so far, his unbelievable unscrupulousness has been matched by a particular degree of idiocy. He has grabbed his wealth without any attempt at concealment, and he has let everyone see the schemes and intrigues by which he hopes to corrupt his judges. Verres says he was only once seriously frightened in his whole life, and that was when I announced I was going to prosecute him. He had recently arrived from his province. The blaze of hostility, though far from new, had only just begun to rage around him, and he struck a bad moment for bribing the court. That is why, when I requested a very brief period to make inquiries into Sicily, he created a diversion by finding someone to ask for a couple of days shorter in order to make inquiries about another governor. I worked hard, though, to complete my mission, but he had not the slightest intention that his nominee should carry out an equally painstaking and industrious job. Indeed, this other investigator never even reached Brundisium. I, on the other hand, spent 50 days on a careful investigation of the entire island of Sicily. I got to know every document, every wrong suffered, even by a community or an individual. Anyone could see, therefore, that this other investigator was not put forward with any genuine idea that his ostensible defendant from Achaia should be prosecuted. No, Verres's real aim was that the time I needed for the case against himself should be occupied by other business. And now listen to this demented scoundrel's present intention. He realises that my preparation and documentation of this trial have been thorough, and that I can consequently pin him down in your hearing and before the eyes of the world as a thief and a criminal. He sees the many senators and knights. He sees the crowds of Romans and allies who he has grievously wronged. He also sees the numerous, highly responsible deputations from communities and friendliest relations with Rome. And in spite of these facts, his estimate of all right-minded men must indeed be low, and his belief in the ruinous corruption of the senatorial courts unbounded. Indeed, he habitually asserts, in public mind, that his passion for money-making is justified, since he finds money such wonderful protection. He has bought something which, by the way, it wasn't easy to buy, namely the date for his own trial. And now that this has been bought, it will be simpler to buy everything else in future. Now, if he had felt the slightest confidence in the strength of his case, or in any honest defence, or in the eloquence or reputation of his supporters, he would surely not have had to chase up and to scrape together all of these things. nor would he have revealed his utter scorn and contempt for the senatorial order, indicated by his arbitrary selection of this other senator who was meant to stand trial first so that he could have time to prepare for his own defence. It is true that with you on this bench, gentlemen, with Glabrio as your president, I do not understand what Verres can hope to achieve. But what I do understand is this. When the judges' names were challenged, the people of Rome came to the same conclusion. Verres' hopes of salvation were based on his money and his money alone. If this protection was removed, he was thoroughly well aware that nothing else could save him. For the greatest brains, fluency and eloquence in the world could not even begin to defend the life this man has led. His innumerable vices and misdeeds have long since received passionate and unanimous condemnation from the entire world. I will leave unmentioned the shames and disgraces of his younger days and turn instead to his quaestorship. Consul and commanding officer, Carbo was left stranded and defenceless, his funds stolen by Verres, his own quaestor at the time. He had to desert his army and abandon his province, and Verres spurned the official lot by which he had been appointed in violation of his sacred duty. As provincial legate, he brought disaster on Asia. Household after household, city after city, shrine after shrine succumbed to his depredations. He even revived and repeated the original scandal of his quaestorship with Dolabella, subjecting him to treacherous abuse. But the most conspicuous and numerous instances of his criminality come from his governorship in Sicily. For 3 long years, he so thoroughly despoiled and pillaged the province that its restoration to its previous state is out of the question. A succession of honest governors over a period of many years could scarcely achieve even a partial rehabilitation. While Verres was governor, the Sicilians enjoyed the benefit neither of their own laws, nor of the Roman Senate's decrees, nor even of the rights to which everyone in the world is entitled. All the property that anyone in Sicily still has is merely what happened to escape the attention of this Avarius lecher. In Sicily, during those 3 years, not a single lawsuit was decided without Verres' connivance. Inheritances were cancelled, if he said the word. Farmers were robbed. Allies of unassailable loyalty were treated as enemies. Roman citizens were tortured and put to death like slaves. Criminals of the deepest kind would bribe their way to acquittal, while men of impeccable honesty were prosecuted. Powerfully fortified harbours, great and well-protected cities were left open for pirates and robbers. Allies and friends of ours were starved to death. Splendid, beautifully equipped fleets were squandered and thrown away. Ancient monuments and temples were stripped bare. It was an appalling disgrace for our country. When I turn to his adulteries and similar outrages, considerations of decency deter me from giving details of these loathsome manifestations of his lusts. Besides, I don't want by describing them to worsen the calamities of the people who have not been permitted to save their children and their wives from Verres' sexual passions. He wasn't quiet about it, though. On the contrary, I reckon that every man alive would be able to recount the atrocities which he has committed. I am more likely, therefore, to be criticised for omitting many of his evil deeds rather than to be suspected of inventing non-existent ones. This great crowd which is gathered here today to listen has not, in my opinion, come to learn from me what happened. No, it has come to go over with my assistance, events of which it is already well aware. But let me tell you what Verres did. First, he returned from his province and then tried to buy up the whole panel of judges. This would have been great, I'm sure, but he was found out, and you honest gentlemen were elected instead. This put him in a very bad mood. He was sure to be condemned. But then the next year's consuls were elected and see the same old intrigues are promptly underway again. Behind them are even larger sums of money, and against your good name and against the well-being of the entire community, this same insidious campaign is being conducted by the same men. Gentlemen, I first learnt what was going on from a minute piece of evidence that came that my way. Quintus Hortensius had just been appointed consul-elect, and a large crowd was escorting him home from the field of Mars. Curio happened to meet them. My allusion to him here, by the way, is not derogatory. On the contrary, for if he had not repeated his words during this encounter, he would have refrained from uttering them so openly and publicly in front of such a large gathering if he didn't want them to be heard. Even so, however, my comments on what he said will be on tentative and guarded terms, because we are very good friends. Well, along the way, Curio caught sight of Verres in the crowd, and he shouted congratulations to him, not, by the way, to Hortensius, who had just been made consul. No, it was Verres who he approached, and with great embraces and assurances, he said, "I hereby proclaim that today's election means your acquittal." This announcement was heard by a large number of reputable witnesses, by the way, and was immediately reported to me, of course. The statement was variously regarded as scandalous or ridiculous. It seemed ridiculous to people who believed the case to depend not on the results of consular elections, but on considerations such as the reliability of the witnesses, the facts, and the powers vested in the judges. Those, on the other hand, who could see further appreciated how scandalous this was, since it implied that members of the court were corrupt. Can all of our private and public archives be totally disregarded if a consul-elect so chooses? Is all power and authority to be vested in one single individual? Gentlemen, I shall speak frankly. This seemed to me a deeply disturbing situation. Then, only a few days later, the presidency of the extortion court went to Marcus Caecilius Metellus. And behold, it was reported to me that Verres had again received warm news. He even sent people home to tell his wife. This did not unduly concern me. No, not until I heard from another reputable source that Verres had gathered all the election agents at his home and reminded them just how good he had been to them, and promised them any sum of money they chose if they would block my election as aedile. Naturally, I was very concerned, but I would not let anything stand in my way of devoting myself to this trial, and thus I discovered the scheme of my opponents, to postpone the case by any available means until Marcus Caecilius Metellus, hear that name again, guys, becomes praetor and president of the court. Why? Well, Marcus Metellus is extremely well disposed to Verres. Secondly, not only will Hortensius then be consul, but his colleague will be Quintus Caecilius Metellus, a very close friend of Verres. You expected me to say nothing about matters as serious as this. But when our country and my honour are in peril, you would be wrong to suppose that I did not place my duty and my obligations before everything else in the entire world. And do you know what Quintus Metellus has been saying? I am consul. One of my brothers is governor in Sicily. The other is going to be president of the extortion court. Many measures have been taken to ensure that Verres will come to no harm. I ask you, Metellus, if that is not corruption, what is? One may well ask what you would do to help a man who was both innocent and your friend. From the new year, Verres said, the entire membership of the court will have changed. However imposing, therefore, may be the prosecutor's threats, however keen popular expectations of the outcome, we shall be able to frustrate them in any way we wish and choose, he said. Today is the 5th of August. You all met at 1:30 in the afternoon. They do not regard today as counting at all. In 10 days' time are Pompey's votive games. Those will take 15 days, and then we had the Roman games following those. So, before having to reply to my charges, they count on almost 40 days' grace. And even then, they reckon by making speeches and other pleading engagements, they'll be able to prolong the case without difficulty until the victory games, which were immediately succeeded by the plebeian games. After all that, there'll be no days or very few left to conclude the trial. They count on these circumstances to damp and exhaust the prosecution, and then the whole case would come up afresh before Marcus Caecilius Metellus when he becomes president of the court. Now, gentlemen, I must ask you what you think I ought to do. I am convinced that your unspoken advice will correspond with what my own understanding tells me is the necessary course. What can be done? The answer does not seem to me particularly complicated, of course. I must save my speech and focus on the evidence. Hortensius, you are the man I have to contend with. You have chosen to fight me by methods more compatible with your client's critical predicament than with your own character. Consequently, I am obliged to find some way of counteracting the tactics you have adopted. Your purpose is to postpone your speech until after the two games. Mine is to reach the adjournment before the first of these games begin. And whereas the ingenuity of your plan will not fail to be appreciated, no one will question that my response has taken the only possible form. You are the man I have to contend with. That's what I began to say. What I meant was this. When the Sicilians had prevailed upon me to take on this case, I felt it a fine compliment that their experience of me as a decent, honest man should have encouraged them to put their trust in my good faith. But I have also formed a more ambitious purpose, namely, to demonstrate to the people of Rome how I feel for my country. One thing, then, that has influenced me is this gloating of yours over your tyrannical dominance in our country. And another is the evident existence of men who feel not the slightest shame or disgust for their repulsive and outrageous behaviour. The pressure of a few unscrupulous rascals has discredited our courts and plunged the entire senatorial order into crisis. That is why my attack on these scoundrels will be implacable. I declare myself their ruthless, irreconcilable, unrelenting enemy. And I claim a duty. I demand it as my own. Regard this as my advance notice, my warning pronouncement as upcoming aedile elected by the people. This is addressed to all who habitually place or accept or promise bribes, in any form and at any stage. I proclaim to you all, right here, right now, don't even think about it. For I am going to disclose to you, with full corroborating evidence, the whole story of all the abominable crimes which have been perpetuated in the courts during these 10 years since they were first transferred to the Senate. Gentlemen, here are the facts. While the equestrians controlled the courts for nearly 50 years, not one single knight who was a judge incurred the slightest suspicion of bribery. Yet after the courts had been transferred to the Senate, it had been remarked that not even an ex-praetor could be convicted for less than 3 million sesterces. I would delay this trial myself, gentlemen, if I tried to recall all the outrages that have been committed. But I must record a fact which many witnesses can corroborate. When Gaius Verres was in Sicily, a number of people heard him saying this kind of thing on, you know, various occasions. I have a powerful friend. Whatever I steal from the province, I am sure he will protect me. My intention is not just to make money for myself. No, I have mapped out 3 years of my Sicilian governorship like this. I shall consider myself to be doing quite nicely if I can earmark 1 year's profits for my own use, the 2nd year's for my protectors and council, and the whole of the 3rd year's, the richest and most lucrative for the judges who try me. I turn to you now, gentlemen. The eyes of the people of Rome are on you now. For here is the man, and here is the case, that will provide an answer to this question. Will a court of senators convict a guilty man if he is rich? The defendant has only 2 characteristics: his appalling record and his exceptional wealth. If, therefore, he is acquitted, the only reasons to which this decision can justifiably be ascribed are the worst. For it will be inconceivable that your leniency towards his numerous and abominable outrages could have been prompted by any personal liking or family tie or any good deed he might have done on other occasions or even by any bad quality which he possessed in only, you know, a mild form. And finally, gentlemen, the facts that I shall be presenting to you in this case will be so notorious and well attested, so glaring and incontrovertible, that no one could possibly attempt to make you acquit Verres as a personal favour. You have been granted this opportunity to bring honour back to our courts. You have heard that I swear to bring drastic retribution. Let justice, honesty, and principle, Glabrio, let that lead the way. Think of your duty to Rome, to our people, and to your ancestors. I am convinced, gentlemen, that this trial would bring you either great popularity or great discredit. To me, it will bring much toil and anxiety, but I will not allow a postponement. There will be no delay. I shall call my witnesses at once. I have made a slight innovation. As I come to each charge in turn, I shall state it in full. I shall go on to cross-examine it, and then I shall call witnesses to that particular charge. So the only deviation from customary routine will be this. Generally, witnesses are not produced until after the conclusion of all the speeches, whereas I am going to call those relating to each individual charge as it is dealt with. Under this procedure, my opponents will have the same opportunities as myself for cross-examining, arguing, and discussing. Anyone who misses the usual continuous speech for the prosecution will have what he wants later. Meanwhile, he must appreciate the necessity for my present programme, which is adopted as a countermeasure to the other side's intrigues. In the first stage of the trial, then, my charge is this. I accuse Gaius Verres of committing many acts of lechery and brutality against the citizens and allies of Rome, and many crimes against God and man. I claim that he has illegally taken from Sicily sums amounting to 40 million sesterces. By the witnesses and documents, public and private, which I am going to cite, I shall convince you that these charges are true. Indeed, you will conclude that even if I had been allowed entire days, all the time I wanted for the presentation of my case, no long speech would have been necessary. At present, I have no more to say.